Hurry, hurry, step right up. The show's about to begin. Forget your troubles and raise your cups. Here's to this moment, it will never happen again.
This is Offstage and On the Air, performance number 671. My name, as it is every Wednesday, is Lisa Sheps. I am joined by my co-host, which this Wednesday is Nicole Shiro.
Hello.
You're listening to us on KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby, streaming live as we do in June at KOOP.org. Remember, if it's theater, it's on Offstage and On the Air. Don't go away.
Hurry, hurry, step right up. The show's about to begin. Forget your troubles and raise your cup. Step right up. Feast your eyes on the wonders of this world. Oh, yeah.
Mama, who bore me? Mama.
It is Wednesday, June 4th, the beginning of our 15th season. On the show today, we have Penfold Theatre Company and their reimagined show, A War of the Worlds. And of course, we will have lively discussions of the world of theater in Austin, New York, Chicago, Germany, and other places. Stick with us.
Find them, but when it comes, they don't know how to go.
Little Leah Michelle to get us started today.
Anything from that show is always good in my book.
Yeah, well, you know what? Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to start off right now before I say anything else, thanking Kim Simpson for another wonderful show.
Yes, we were all even commenting before we came live on air today that we were all jamming out.
We were
good stuff. Kim always does good stuff.
We love that International Folk Bazaar. Thank you, Kim Simpson, and we're going to give him a shout out. Shout out!
Shout out to Kim.
And then before we say anything else, I'm going to introduce our panel of experts that are here.
Yes, please do.
Yanina Barber Payne, hi. Welcome back to Offstage and On the Air and the first live appearance.
Yes, yes. Thank you.
Mark Puhay, always great to have you here.
Great to be here. Really happy.
And Jarrett King.
Hello,
so
hello.
Good to have you back all the way from the Windy City.
Yeah, it's great to be back. Thank you for having me.
Yay.
I bet you're wondering why I'm playing Spring Awakening at the beginning of Pride Month.
Tell me, Lisa.
Well, they don't have anything to do with one another in this case. I finally watched it. I don't know if anybody else has. There's a documentary about Spring Awakening.
I was like, the documentary?
I watched it. Did anybody else see it?
No,
I started it, and then, you know, when the on-demand box goes, like, all haywire on you and says, not working, error, come back? Yeah, that all happened.
No,
so I hadn't gone back yet.
I don't get that box. My on-demand stuff works. So it's a documentary about Spring Awakening. You know, they just did the 25th anniversary. Can't be the 25th. 20th anniversary. Anniversary concert where the whole original cast came together for a concert version. And they married this with footage from the original and the 2006. But, you know, they didn't have any of the...
but they didn't interview they didn't any have of the newer...
The right? They did not have the Deaf West version at all.
Huh.
Which, by the way, I will remind everybody that I had tickets to closing night. And I couldn't go because of two things. Snowpocalypse, which would have kept me away anyway. But that was also when Ground Floor Theater got shut down the first time that day. So it was in January of 2016.
That's what we call a double feature.
It wasn't. But anyway, what a wonderful... documentary it is, and
you're gonna make me go back and watch that now, Lisa.
Now, you're gonna say I'm stupid, but I totally didn't realize. I kept watching. I said, darn it, that guy looks like Skylar Astin. They must have just brought him in because they needed another person.
That is where I discovered the Skylar Astin.
Had no idea he was in the original. But the best part of this was Jonathan. It was basically Jonathan Groff, Leah Michelle and one other guy, I forgot.
And Andy?
No. Stop. Don't. Anyway, I'll come up with it. Same name as the guy that was in Franny's Invisible Playlist.
Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist.
Yeah. Same guy that played the father that had a stroke. Same name.
Gallagher.
So anyway, it was set up as an interview with them. But
we play this game.
Peter Gallagher, yeah. What was interesting is this relationship between Jonathan Groff and Lea Michele. Jonathan was a closeted gay man, and they were like, they were, Lea Michele was 14 years old when she started working on that.
Yes.
And 19 when it closed. So she was 18 when it was playing on Broadway. Just the incredible journey that this show had. And they, when they opened on Broadway before the Tonys, it was an 1,100 seat house that they were playing to 300 people. And the Tony Awards was a big shock to them because they won every award. And that changed everything for all of those people's lives. And now, you know, Jonathan Groff right now is, you know, well, a lot of them are internationally known, but I just think of him and
Skylar's doing pretty good.
No, I said they're all doing really well.
He's got a brand new show out.
I keep thinking of him in Hamilton and how mature and everything is. And he was just this naive little kid from Iowa, I think.
Wow.
No. Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
We're all young peanuts at some point in our lives.
I wasn't. So I recommend folks watching it. So just to keep the whole documentary thing going, I also watched this new Company documentary.
Oh, did you watch that?
I did.
You were unsure if you wanted to watch it or
well,
not.
And you know what? As it turns out, I'm not, I'm ambivalent about seeing it. It's not, but it was still good. I love the music of Company, but it was very interesting. It basically follows this current production with Katrina Link, but it also goes back and you get a lot of footage from the very first, but it's just very interesting how they break it down.
Okay.
The show itself and why it started and how it doesn't have a narrative. And I never really thought of that before, but it doesn't have a narrative. There's no story.
It's got a lot of good songs.
It's just these little vignettes. Right. And it was good. I didn't want to see it because I said, you know, I saw the documentary on the making of the soundtrack, which was an amazing documentary.
Right.
I've heard it's very good.
Oh, you haven't seen it?
I haven't seen
you
it.
You should.
But yeah.
This is everybody's homework.
Yeah.
So you were like, I know, I get that. You like have such a good peace and memory in your mind. You're like, do I go there? Mm-hmm. Do I just leave it there? Yeah.
That's true.
But I recommend it. I must recommend it. And they were talking about everything. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Katrina Link, who did not get great notices in this, but I still love her.
That's okay. I like her too.
Yeah. And she called me yesterday and I told her I was going to talk about it. So there I've done it.
Oh, well, I hope you tell her I say hi next time.
I did. Well, while we're talking about Sondheim, I'll just jump right to
you have
Into the
more?
Woods.
Oh, yes.
Which we've talked like, about. Who's a huge fan of Into the Woods?
I
cannot
I
say.
Love a good
Into the I saw movie. It for the first time at Loyola, where I work, and
in Chicago.
In Chicago. I was. I'm afraid to share my thoughts.
No, I'm not.
Lisa doesn't like it.
Well, no, I like it. I'm just not in love with it.
Sure, I think that's
a
little more.
I don't think it's God's gift to theater.
Yeah.
I never thought it was God's gift to theater, but I do.
Some
love
people
it.
Do think,
but
it
I
is.
Don't think it's God's gift to theater.
No. Some people.
I've heard it depends on the production. Like it depends on like
there are versions I have seen that have been so awful that I'm like, if that's what someone saw for the first time, I'm so sorry because like it's a really good show. Yes. Like yes.
Well,
I think
as everyone knows, it had a 2-week encores program at City Center.
Yes, with the most excellent
with
cast.
With Sarah Bareilles and Gavin Creel. Sarah Bareilles playing the baker's wife and Gavin Creel playing a prince and the wolf. The baker was Neil Patrick Harris.
I was like, where's the MPH? Because the Christian Borle was there and then he rolled back out to go back to the little shop.
And then Joshua Henry was in the other. So they are moving to Broadway.
Yes.
For an eight week run, and it's going to continue having Sarah Bareilles and Gavin Creed. Out is MPH and in is BAJ. No, BDJ, sorry.
Okay.
I was about to say, I thought it was Brian Dixon, right?
No, it's Brian Darcy James.
Oh, it's Brian Darcy James. Okay.
But I'm looking at it written, Dixon, sorry. And the Darcy is little D, big A. And that's why it's A. But Brian Darcy James is playing the baker.
That's another
and
good
I'm very
casting
excited
choice.
That Patina Miller is playing the witch.
Oh, wow.
I like that's Patina.
I love Patina Miller. And I thank you all the time for making me go see that version of Pippin with her in it because Pippin, another show, don't like. move it along, buddy. Find yourself. Like, music's great. Didn't want to go. Lisa told me to go see this. Was the greatest thing I've ever seen. It made me love Pippin. And
this was the Diane Paulus version that uses a circus theme throughout it. It's actually really good, except, in my opinion, I don't like the new ending.
Yeah.
And if people do it now, they have the choice of the old ending, which they should do, mm-hmm. and the new ending that they don't. Stephen Schwartz, am I right? Who wrote it?
I think Stephen Schwartz. Schwartz.
Okay. He says he prefers the new ending, which I think he's out of his mind.
I don't know. All I know is I thank you all the time for telling me to go. I was like,
How do other people feel about Pippin?
I have never seen it. I have listened to it. We've got magic to do. I know that one.
The music in it's the corner of the sky. Got to find my corner. Come on.
We always sing on this show.
Of the sky. It's good stuff. Yeah. So if you do see a bad production, please do give it another chance.
Like, I saw it in the 70s with
Ben Vereen.
Is it Ben Vereen?
Oh, no, wow. I think he was. No, it wasn't Ben Vereen. It was the black guy that was in Sesame Street. He killed himself very tragically.
Oh.
You would know him. I can't remember his name. But the guy that played Pippin was Greg from Brady Bunch. Oh.
Interesting choice.
Yeah. Anyway, it's going to be it's going to start previews on the 28th, open on July 10th at the St. James Theater. It'll play for 8 weeks. And again, we're not talking Pippin, we're talking Into the Woods.
Yeah. I would be interested in seeing it.
Yeah,
but I don't know.
Okay, we had one very interesting opening, Fat Ham. Which opened, I think, last Thursday.
I read about that.
Yeah.
I believe so.
So I can't remember anybody's name. So I've got to get to my.
Did it win the Pulitzer?
I mean, why can't you remember? Why can't you remember full cast names, Lisa?
I don't know. It won the Pulitzer without ever having a performance, which is interesting.
Isn't that
so? It's having its first performance now, and the it is written by James Imes. And the reason why I had to wait for my thing to come up is because his last name is spelled capital I-J-A-M-E-S. Mm-hmm. And it's pronounced Imes. I had to find some places that they said, it's like Times without the T. But the review in the Times is by Maya Phillips. She made it a critic's pick. It's directed by Sahim Ali at the Public Theater, and it's a presentation with the National Black Theater. So this imagines the Hamlet story, loosely based on the Hamlet story as a black family. I don't know where it's set. Maybe Detroit. I think it's Detroit.
I feel like that sounds correct now that you say that.
But it's interesting. I'm not going to go into too much detail because quite frankly, I read the review and I still don't really understand what a lot of it's about, but it's basically the Hamlet story.
I kind of like that though, because then you go and you form your own thoughts and ideas and then go back later and see and explore different nuggets when you're reading other stuff.
Right. But one of the things she says is, quote, what would normally be a story about revenge instead becomes one about toxic masculinity and homophobia that plagued the black community. That played the black community, period. You was soft, Reverend says to Juicy with a sneer, and the men in our family ain't soft. And I started to think, look at this little pocket of nothing. Just seems really interesting the take they're doing on it.
That's cool.
I don't think there's an Ophelia analog in this one.
When does that close?
I gotta go. I don't know that. I think it's an open.
Is this open-ended at this point?
I was like, I don't think there was a closing date on it.
Okay. Nope, July 3rd.
Oh.
Never mind.
Well.
At the Public. So I would like to see it.
I know.
Really?
Like, we're doing an East Coast road trip.
Okay. Well, you never
I'm gonna
know.
I'm going to miss it. I'm going to miss it. Dang.
Well, it could extend. Jazz hands out to the universe.
Jazz hands, out. Yes. So if everybody was watching, we're all jazz handing.
We're all jazz handing here.
Did you read this article about Beanie Feldstein missing like a gazillion shows?
She basically hasn't been in the show, and it's been her understudy, who apparently is like
amazing.
The shizzle. Like awesome sauce, and everybody can't stop talking about her.
Wow. Yeah, she's supposed to be amazing in it, but she's missing shows for Nobody really knows why.
Yeah, yeah. I'm wondering.
And it's been from the very beginning.
Whoa. I was about to say, and I think this started like within a day or two after opening. Like this isn't just Mr. Chunk, maybe sick, this and that.
Right.
I thought maybe it was vocal, but this seems like a long time. I don't know.
I don't know either.
I wish her well. But I love her.
Yep. Yep, me too. What I found interesting, in this article that was written by Roger Friedman in showbiz411.com, they talk about plenty of Broadway stories about understudies who took over the lead role and became famous. Mm-hmm. And I did not know this. Evidently, that's how Shirley MacLaine got her start in Pajama Game.
I was about to say Shirley MacLaine in Pajama Game and Sutton Foster. Those are two of the greatest understudy.
Sutton Foster, that was a great story because that's when she's doing two shows at once, right?
That was when it was Thoroughly Modern Millie.
No, but they don't mention her. They mention Michelle Lee in How to Succeed.
Oh, yes. Michelle Lee in How to Succeed was another one.
But I did not. I did not realize that.
I knew that was Shirley MacLaine. But that's also probably because of my whole like Fosse MacLaine ranking.
All those people.
Gwen Verdon obsession. So that's probably why.
So I knew that. In the New York Times on the 26th, they talk about 18 arts organizations of color selected for this national initiative from the Wallace Foundation, which aims to foster equity and improvements in the arts. This is an amazing thing. 18 companies out of 250 applications are getting upwards of, or up to $3.5 million each over a course of 3 years to grow their organizations. And what I found interesting, I circled this with an exclamation point, so I have to read it. I don't know what it says. This article is written by Laura Zornosa, and she's quoting somebody here who I don't know, but this is quoting somebody. One of the things that distinguishes this opportunity is the acknowledgement that organizations of color have had a certain history of undercapitalization, says Arnaldo Lopez, the managing director of Pregones PRTT, one of the companies that's getting the money. And that means that for many years, compared to primarily white-serving organizations in the arts and culture, we worked with a fraction of the money. So I think that's... I mean, talk about the definition of equity and what they're doing. That's pretty amazing.
It is amazing.
This current round is for organizations that have a budget of $500,000 or above.
Okay.
They're going to do another one with organizations with budgets of less than $500,000. So I just think that's
I thought
that's
that was
amazing.
Cool when I saw them, because I was like, well, this is great for big, but this would be great for the smaller one. And then I saw that announcing of the other initiative, and I was like, okay, well, Jazz Hand again for that one. And Jazz Hand's more for more things like that, programs out there. That was awesome sauce.
Yeah, I think it's great. So on the other side of the fence... and this was you and I were talking about it. Are you familiar with House Theater in Chicago?
Closed. Just announced.
Closed. I was not familiar with it, but because they came into being like a year before I left Chicago, but they were housed mostly in my neighborhood, the oh my God, what's the name of the theater? The Chopin Theater in Wicker Park, which I've been to many times. As a matter of fact, I had an accident in a cab on my way to that theater. But it's effective in July, but they've ceased doing anything.
I was like,
now.
But they're not doing anything else. They're a bunch of, they have a Texas connection.
They have a complete Texas.
SMU alumni.
Right. 100% Texas connection. A bunch of white guys from SMU, as
well,
it turns out.
Well, I mean, it's SMU. Are we really surprised?
Yeah.
Sure.
But here's the interesting thing is, so in 501c3 theater, we work, you know, primarily on unearned revenue, that is donations and grants. And our earned revenue, meaning ticket sales and concessions, you know, are a minuscule part of our overall budget. They worked on a 70% earned income.
Oh, wow.
Which was great until the pandemic.
Right.
I was about to say,
it's
great. And I think the pandemic took them out. But to sustain that model for 20 years,
pretty amazing.
It made me stop and go, kind of like have a conversation with these people. Mm-hmm. Like, what were you doing to have 70? Like, that number just blew my mind.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So at its peak, it had a budget close to $3 million. And it went down to 100,000.
Oh, gosh.
They lost 2.1 million in ticket sales, that's why.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. And they had a lot of criticism because of their lack of diversity. And they had actors occasionally playing characters that were races other than their own. And they also had a feeling of a white bro culture. But right in 2020, when the founding artistic director stepped down, they hired a woman to take over who was taking it in a different direction. But they I don't think they could just survive the...
I don't know how you do that in the midst of chaos.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I thought that was interesting.
Yes.
Wow.
Okay, we have time for a couple more. What do we want to talk about? Let's look at the list. Andre DeShields, Out of Hadestown.
I know. I love that man.
his last show was last Sunday. Mm-hmm. And speaking of that, other shows that closed last Sunday, or other things that closed, well, these are shows. Well, in the same vein, he's no longer in Hadestown.
I was like, Hadestown is still playing.
These shows closed. Birthday Candles, Mrs. Doubtfire, and Skin of Our Teeth. What a loss to Hadestown.
Yeah.
I don't know who's replacing him. Anybody?
Oh, I do know, and I forgot. But he's so awesome. He's so delectable in that role. Like,
haven't seen it. So I'm looking forward to coming here.
It made me laugh. Like, you know, like... Just realize, oh yeah, from the Full Monty, like I saw him in the Full Monty, and then like to see him, and like I just love seeing actors playing different roles throughout the years, and it's like, you know, but then 20, 30 years later, you have that epiphany of, wait a minute, I saw them in this doing this, and whoa, how spent, like.
There you go.
Yeah.
I got
to see that Hadestown right before everything shut down.
Yeah. It is coming here in September.
Is the reschedule as part of the Texas Performing Arts.
Looking forward
Broadway
to seeing
season.
It because I didn't get to see it. I did. Their choice of, I guess in 2019 Tony Awards, where they performed. I forgot which one, but I did not. It did not look good to me in the Tony Awards. That was the number with the swinging lamps. It didn't do anything for me.
Oh, yeah. I did think that was just an odd choice. But I think it was also, too, because they wanted to get Spidey out there. Lee Carney.
Oh, okay. Wasn't following you, but I found
Listen, he's really good in Hadestown, and he actually was really good in Spider-Man. I don't know what to tell you. Didn't say the show was good. He was good.
He was okay. Yeah.
The flying was everything, though, Lisa.
Yeah, we've had this discussion over and over again. I was unimpressed. But in more crazy drama, the Utah Shakespeare Festival, their artistic director abruptly stepped down.
I heard about this, yeah.
No reason stated.
That's not good.
Yeah.
As a publicist, I was like, that's not a good answer.
No.
That's not a good look.
I'm guessing we all probably think it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know, and it hasn't been announced at all. But he stepped down on the 25th. And the festival's release said the festival cannot comment on any specifics of individual personnel matters.
Fascinating.
Which is
there's no word from the festival.
Take it full circle.
We have no word.
So he was scheduled to act in Sweeney Todd. Mm. So one would assume he's no longer going to be doing that.
I don't think he's really going to be doing a lot of things lately.
So they do. They are committed to keeping this schedule on. Their schedule is All's Well That Ends Well.
Except it's a part of
the universe was having a good time with this one.
Sweeney Todd, King Lear, Sound of Music. I mean, all of these.
Yeah, this is very
Trouble in Mind.
Oh my God.
Clue, The Tempest, Thurgood, and Words Cubed.
Oh, I've never heard of that one.
So they plan to keep that going. And that takes us up to our first break. We just yipper yapper, yipper yipper yapper.
There's lots of good stuff to talk about.
So we're going to go to break, and we're going to hear a little bit of Andre DeShields from that amazing show.
Oh, yes.
Hadestown. We'll be right back. And we are back. You're listening to Offstage and On the Air with Lisa.
And Nicole.
And a whole bunch of other people that we're about to reintroduce.
I know, it's very exciting. We all had private horn sections in our heads going on.
We were singing along. Singing along, living a song. Let's introduce our folks again who are here now. No longer just folks talking about theater, but specifically representing Penfold Theater Company and their show, A Reimagining of A War of the Worlds, written by Jarrett King. And we are fortunate enough to have here in the studio, Jarrett King.
Hello.
Yay!
It's me.
And two of the performers, Yunina Barber Payne.
Hi,
Yunina.
Hello, hi.
Yay. We rarely get applause
this
here.
This is an exciting bunch today. We're having a good time.
Yeah. And Mark Puhe.
Hey.
Yay!
So I keep talking about this show, and I keep saying it's a reimagined War of the Worlds, but that's where I leave it. So,
yeah.
Jarrett, tell folks what you mean by a reimagined War of the Worlds.
Sure. Yeah. You know, it's interesting because something I feel like I've been exploring a bit in my work has been kind of like plays that ask, like, what if? You know, like the what if question. So this play definitely asks a big what if. And essentially it does reimagine this moment in history where, you know, Orson Welles had, if you are familiar, had sort of orchestrated this broadcast adaptation on the radio of the War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells in 1938. And a lot of folks believe that it was real. It was sort of reimagined to be this like fake news broadcast. And, you know, reports vary, but he apparently fooled a lot of folks.
He fooled a lot of people.
A lot of people.
I was around then.
Yeah. I don't believe that. I don't believe that at all. See, again, fooling a lot of folks on the radio. Very on brand.
I remember I drove my Studebaker off a cliff.
Oh my god. My steam-powered Studebaker.
See, you can do the news with me. Little Gloria Vanderbilt came out of the court today.
Yes. I can't do that voice as much as I try.
It's all about the shake.
All about the shake.
You just have to report. Oh, Mark Puhe will be reporting with me today when we go back to the news.
Oh my god. So good.
Sorry about that. And yet we digress.
But yeah, so essentially this play reimagines that event and reimagines Orson Welles and his troupe of actors in Mercury Theater on the Air as a group of black actors sort of on the verge of, like, you know, being shut down. You know, they weren't getting enough viewers, all that good stuff. And that is true to life. You know, part of the reason why we have this broadcast in our history is because, you know, the viewership was low. And so to sort of like try to get this sponsorship, everybody's looking for sponsorship. And that was definitely a time when sponsorship was like a big thing. You know, this show sort of represents the sort of, you know, stunt that was pulled then and sort of reimagines then, like, if you take that and put it under a different lens of like, what if these folks were black?
Right.
In 1938 in New York, what do you get? Like, how does it change the story? So it is very much about that. It's about fake news, quote unquote. It's about xenophobia and all of those things, which are naturally wrapped up in that event. But that, you know, we as folks in a modern lens can't help but look at.
Exactly.
You know, and make that connection ourselves. So, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's fascinating. So in research, so my familiarity with War of the Worlds is the movie. And of course, just knowing about Orson Welles doing the radio broadcast, but I didn't really get anything about the backstory and the things that were happening behind the scenes about trying to bring people in. I'm assuming you researched all that and found all that stuff out and then putting that on a lens of a group of black players must have been challenging.
For sure, definitely. I mean, research is tough. I find myself very impatient with it because I'm like, I just want to write the play. I just want to do the writing thing. But it was very helpful. And I think that, you know, part of reimagining it allows me to sort of like pause the research and sort of say, like, okay, now what's my own research? What do I want to research in my own brain to then sort of bring forward to tell this story? Because at some point, that's the major part of the fuel that's going to like get me through this play is like that research within what I want to, the story I want to tell. So I knew I didn't want to make it like a traditional like biopic or, you know, that sort of vibe. So, you know, I was excited then to find a concept and land on this concept and to then, you know, run with it from there. So
did you find a fine line of, I mean, the piece itself is so well known, so that makes it a totally different beast. Like, did you find a fine line of how to honor and stay traditional to that piece, but to take your own take sure. on everything.
Yeah. Well, yeah. The piece itself is so dense and has so much, thankfully, there. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, I was very much sort of interested in like, how do I, you know, sort of find these elements of surprise? And that was fun for me and thrilling for me to not know where I was going and to sort of like feel my way through. And then, and you know, I would always sort of tell my like students whenever I teach playwriting is like, if you don't know where you're going, and that's actually kind of a really thrilling place because the audience, that means the audience will probably be in the same boat as you. They're like, oh, I don't know where this is going, you know?
And I
should be
like
a playwright. I never know where I'm going.
That's why I ended up here. Yes, absolutely. So yes, I was trying to find ways and definitely wanted to find ways to put a modern audience in the shoes of the listeners back in 1938 mm-hmm. in the sense of like, I think we look back at this event and we think like, oh, I would never be fooled mm-hmm. by a fake radio broadcast, right? But actually, like we walk around with a little radio in our pocket all day, and we're fooled
24/7.
Yes,
yeah, even
yes.
more so. And so, absolutely. Mark, you are actually playing Orson Welles, are
that
you not?
Correct. Yes, I am.
So that's got to be challenging on a couple of notes. But mm-hmm. you are no stranger to playing iconic roles. So what is exciting about this one? What's different about this one? Tell us how you feel.
Well, I like the premise that Jarrett came up with. For one, I think one thing that we want to make sure we mention that Orson directed an all-black version of Macbeth that you know toured the country and was right. you know doubted and people were scared of it. They didn't want to put it up, but it got these people work over and over, and it was a federally funded program. Mm-hmm.
That was in the 30s.
That
amazing.
Was just about a year or two before this. He and his producing partner, John Houseman, founded the Mercury Theater Company. He laid the crumbs, and I just did more research and dug a little bit up. But the thing that I love about Welles is just his character, his presence. His voice is unmistakable, mm-hmm. But we each, myself, Yanina, all the other actors who are on the radio, we each have multiple characters and multiple pieces of the story that we're telling. And to your point, Nicole, so much of the broadcast is verbatim.
Yes.
Like yeah. Jarrett didn't, yes. it's like adapting Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
He left the verse there, and it's like the times when the mic is off, that's when the comedy and the drama and the fear and the tension comes because, you know, the drama itself is in the original language, but Jarrett's done such a great job of fleshing the story out that it is truly terrifying at points. It really is.
As you say that with a smile.
But no, it's an honor to play a character like this. And you're always tempted to, you know, you want to just say, well, let me just watch some videos and mimic him and just turn it on and remember the voice and just go on autopilot. No, you can't do that.
Yeah, that's how you do things. That's how yeah. you've done everything else, right?
Yeah. I mean, you want to find as much of yourself as you can in the character and things that you have in common with him. One thing that I found out is he and I were the same height and we were both husky men. You know, I figured that's something that I could, you know, make, even though
I didn't realize Orson Welles was so tall.
He was
I actually thought he was shorter in stature in my land, I guess. Like, yeah.
Well, he spent most of his later years sitting down and pontificating.
That's what it was.
He probably looked about 3 or 4 feet tall in his later years. But
I must have been reporting at the courthouse. I missed him in person.
So when we talk about this piece, it is kind of a play within a play.
Yes.
You've got the radio broadcast, but then you have the drama that's going on behind the scenes. And so that leads me to Yanina. So what role are you playing in this show? Or is it multiple roles?
So it's multiple, and there is the role of Edna Thomas, who is the actress that's involved in the radio broadcast alongside the other players in the Mercury Theater. And she is really a real person, right? So like Jarrett has done a beautiful job of giving us an opportunity to get access to research and information around players, black, specifically notable black players during the time period that were making strides and were actually having a strong presence mm-hmm. and doing a lot of great influential things on stage and off stage. And Edna Thomas is one of those figures. So I just have to say that was the gem and the nugget of like coming up, being a part of this experience is like, I remember saying to Marcus, like, why didn't I ever know about Edna Thomas? Mm-hmm. Why didn't I learn about her? Why wasn't she in any of my curriculum? And so to be able to play her, knowing that when she comes into this space, she already has been known as a leading lady. She's already established in the theater community there. And so she's coming in and with these players that she's been playing with for a while to bring this vision to life. And I think that the tension that is, the stakes are high, right? That the talent that she brings in collaboration with the others is something that stands out and is fun to play with.
So Edna Thomas was a real performer, a black performer.
Yes.
Is she, was there a person in the radio broadcast that she is replacing? Like, I assume that the female talent was not black in Orson Welles' real version. Is there an analog between those? Or
no, there were no female talents in
the world. I was like, I don't think there were any ladies. Were there?
Really? The farmer was, I heard the farmer, it's a man, but she does a fantastic job.
Let's hear it.
You gotta pay $16 to starting Thursday. But she does a fantastic job that creates another bit that I'm like, save us some for the sequel.
So much fun, right? But that's the beauty of it, right? It's thinking about what does it mean to be someone who is already good and known for their craft and coming into this space with the intervention of now it's a female player and also among these cast of greats that they're known for the work that they've done. Like, what does it mean to have those quips? So much fun.
That's amazing. So do all the other actors have an actor to, like, Yanina's got... I forgot her name. Edna Thomas to sort of grab onto as a character. Did you assign actors to all of the other performers?
Yeah. It's interesting. As part of my research, I found actually. So Mark mentioned the all black production of Macbeth that Orson Welles sort of created, and I actually found a photocopy online of his prompt book. And it has the cast list and his notes in the margin, all that stuff.
Okay, that's so cool.
That's wild. That's when research is like real fun. This stuff. And so, it had the whole cast list. And so what I did was I was like, okay, like based on this cast, like who from this cast can I now cast in this show? So, in that production of Macbeth, there was this actor named Wardell Saunders who played Malcolm. And I was like, okay, well, I have this kind of young scrappy guy in my play. Maybe that's this guy. And then Ollie, who's sort of the sound engineer in the show, maybe I'm like, okay, well, maybe this guy is the first murderer or whatever. So let me take that guy out. And, maybe he's not much of an actor, but he kind of hangs out. And so he played this role.
Is Canada Banquo?
Canada's Banquo. Oh, yes, man. Canada Lee. Yeah.
Canada's my best friend.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Which is scary.
right. Yeah. So that was really fun to sort of cast the show from this existing piece of this artifact, essentially.
So that's fun. And it's got to be fun as a performer to think that. So you're doing this play, and then every now and then you step into the role of actor doing a radio play, which is a completely different discipline.
Yes.
That's got to be kind of fun to go back and forth.
It is.
Absolutely. And I think that that's the fun of the craft, right? It's being able to think about two different mediums at once, and then the element of live theater, which now we get to do again.
Yes.
So exciting.
We had this benefit of the pandemic, which was also, we shifted to radio and made it or back to a concept of radio drama. So to be able to merge the two feels so much fun.
And exciting. I know you have some great people involved. Marcus McWhorter is the director.
Yes.
Marcus, I don't know if he's been on our show before, but he heads up the theater department over at ACC.
Yes.
What are some of the other players that we might want to highlight here on the show?
Buzz Moran. I feel like, I just have to shout out Buzz. He's of course, known for, Foley and all of that. And that really lends such a important texture to the show.
Also, and we should note that Buzz did the Intergalactic Nemesis. Oh my God.
Salvage Vanguard?
Yeah, but what's his name? Who started Salvage Vanguard? Oh, I just lost his name.
Anyway.
It's okay. We'll come up with it. Who else?
Yes. You mentioned Amy Lewis doing lights. Desiree Humphreys doing costumes. I feel like this is a pop quiz because I'm like,
who are some of the other performers?
Other performers. I'm gonna miss some people. I feel like a jerk because there's eight of us.
We'll help
you. The first that I want to mention is Judd Ferris, my old college buddy. We both went to Texas State. We got Sarah Byington, who plays Lewis.
Kenya.
Kenna Benefield, who plays Wardell, and then Dane.
And John Christopher plays it.
That's it. We did it.
Yep, you did it.
You did. I was trying to pull it up.
Well, we did it with Yanina's help, which is like Edna. Edna is always making sure that Orson doesn't make a fool of himself.
Awesome. So y'all open tomorrow, is that correct?
Yeah.
And that's June 2nd. How long do you play?
Three weeks.
Yeah. 3 weeks. Closes on the 18th.
It's my birthday.
Oh, happy birthday to you.
I'm the 25th. I'm right after. I'm a week later.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Hello, birthday friend.
There we go. Where can folks go to get more information about this show?
Groundfloortheater.org.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you could do that, but probably better would be PenfoldTheater.org.
PenfoldTheater.org, yes.
But there is a link on groundfloortheater.org as well. So you are playing, obviously, at Ground Floor Theater, and this is a Penfold Theater production. So just as someone who's loosely tied to Ground Floor Theater, I can't wait to have y'all in the theater. <You're already
there. laughs> I was like, didn't you just move in?
So
she's being modest. I walk in and see every trophy over the last 10 years with her name all over the place.
No. That's the trophies for the theater. You have that many trophies for you.
That's legit.
But did y'all know that there was a War of the Worlds musical?
No.
I did not know that.
There was. And hold on. It was a concept album. And it is Jeff Wayne's musical version of the War of the Worlds, starring a whole bunch of British people that I don't know. But it is narrated by Richard Burton.
Ooh.
Whoa.
Wow.
Really?
Yes.
The money was good.
It was. So this was in 1978, and it continues to have a life. I think when I look at this, there's something all the way into 2018 anniversary tour.
Wow!
Then there's stuff in. There's a tour again, 2022. 21 and 22. And I'm getting all this information from Wikipedia, so you know it's true.
So crazy.
Yeah. So anyway, we're going to walk away listening to a little bit of that show, and we're going to listen to Thunder Child, and we'll hear a little bit of Richard Burton's sultry and sexy voice. Thank you all for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
That was Jarrett King, Yanina Barber-Payne, and Mark Pouet, all of Penfield Theater Company's War of the Worlds, playing June 2nd through the 18th at Ground Floor Theater. For more information, penfoldtheater.org. We will be back.
The steamer began to move slowly away, but on the landward horizon.
Who was that sexy voice?
Who was that? I need to know that person.
Those of you listening to the podcast don't hear that, so you have no idea what we're talking about.
No.
But it was me. So there's some local stuff I want to talk about. First of all, something I meant to talk about last week that I didn't, and we'll see if the rest of you. I saw Somebody Loves You, Mr. Hatch at Zach.
Oh, wonderful.
Did anybody see it?
I did. Opening week. Yeah.
What a sweet little play.
Very sweet.
That
very
none
sweet.
Of you can see now because it's closed.
I know, but there but is a little sweet album play. And maybe it'll come back one day. I told you I got all worked up and was crying telling you about it. I'm like, it just brings me to tears because it's just so heartwarming.
And I was chosen to act in it.
From the audience?
Were you?
Yeah.
Oh,
I got yay. I got to buy a newspaper.
Yay! That's excellent. That Alan Robertson gives us such little treats.
Very, very sweet play. So, I would recommend folks to go see it. But when it comes back, it's a theater for young audience. But it's I'm just past the age of young audience, and I loved it.
Yeah.
And it was good to see. It was just good to see, and it was adult actors and one child actor that shifted between three performers, and we had on the show one of them, and the one I saw was not that person, so I got to experience a little bit.
Oh, you got
two different peoples. Mm-hmm.
We spoke to Chloe when. So you either got.
I got
Samantha
one of the other two.
Yeah.
There's a 66% chance you'll know which one.
Yeah, maybe.
Or 33%. Yeah. I don't know. Don't make me do math. Other things locally that I wanted to talk about is Lifespan of a Fact. Jarrett Productions is doing a digital version that people can see of the same show that they did last month. I thought I had information on here, but I don't.
Probably at Jarrett Productions.
Yeah, jarrettproductions.org. I actually have that written in here so I wouldn't forget it. Not org, com, jarrettproductions.com. And the other thing I want to talk about is an article that was sent to me by one Nicole Shiro, but also was in the briefing today. But you sent it to me before I saw the briefing. And it's a national article, but it has local connections. The article from
American... Which article? I sent you a lot today.
Yeah, from the American Theater magazine, Alexandra Wales. Nope, wrong. She did not write it. It doesn't have the person who wrote the article. Maybe it's at the end. Anyway, it's from American Theater magazine, and it's called The Deaf Renaissance Beyond Coda. And did everybody here see the movie Coda?
I'm not seeing it.
Oh my God! Required seeing.
Definitely.
It's just a beautiful, from a hearing person's perspective, it's a great show. And my friend Brian Cheslick, who runs Deaf Austin Theater, says from a deaf perspective, it's also very good. And it stars Mary Matlin and a whole bunch of people that I don't know their names. But Coda, as everyone knows, is Child of a Deaf Adult. And in this case, this child wants to sing in the choir. And her parents fight it because they can't hear. So singing isn't part of their culture. And it's just a very interesting, touching story. But it won
numerous.
I was like, yeah. Lots of things.
So one of the things this article said is that there's a renaissance of deaf representation right now, whereas once upon a time it wasn't. We really only knew
Marley Matlin
mm-hmm. and John Rubenstein in, what's the name of that show?
Children of a Lesser God.
Thank you. Yeah. Which they tried to revive
recently. Yeah.
Recently, and it got panned because it's not very sensitive to people who are deaf. And so there were a whole bunch of things last summer, including with deaf actors. Richard III for Colored Girls, The Cherry Orchard, The Music Man, and To Kill a Mockingbird all had deaf actors in it. But it was interesting that in each of those, none of these roles were written for deaf actors. And this is one of the things that happens. And we did it, Ground Floor Theater did it at with Fun Home when we hired a deaf actor to play one of the characters who's not deaf, but we made her deaf for that show. But this is talking about all the things that are going on. And they talk about, you know, Deaf West's two Broadway productions, Spring Awakening, going full circle, and Big River. And Big River, I didn't see it, but I saw their Tony performance. And that's what got me interested in wanting to do a deaf performance, which got Ground Floor Theater started in this whole thing and got us attached to Deaf Austin Theater. So speaking of that, one of the shows that they talk about is, what is it? The King and I? Not The King and I. That Sandra May is, Frank is co-directing.
The Music Man.
Which we had talked about here on this show. And Sandra May Frank is, I thought we talked about it, is co-directing. And
With Michael Barron,
who...
director of the Lyric Opera.
They were also talking about... I'm going to go back. Both Deaf West productions, Spring Awakening and... oh my God, what's wrong with me? We just said it.
Big River.
Hearing directors.
Yes.
With no deaf assistant directors.
Which is so...
Or co-directors. And
mind-boggling to me.
But in this National Theater Magazine, there's a whole paragraph and a half dedicated to Deaf Austin Theater and Brian Cheslick, which I just love. And they talk about our production of Next to Normal, which we did in conjunction with Deaf Austin Theater. But they are also doing, at Ground Floor Theater, and this will not be a co-production, it will be Deaf Austin Theater only, the Laramie Project. And they got permission directly from Moises Kaufman to do it fully deaf. So I encourage folks to read that article.
It was a really great piece. It was a great piece to see other people highlighted, not the same thing, and to acknowledge a lot of things that they acknowledged in there. You and I have had this conversation. How do you not act ask a non-hearing director to be a part of something.
Well, which has always been the case. And frankly...
yeah, I know. You and I were just talking about that. This shouldn't have had to happen now. Like, no, where's everyone been?
I didn't finish the sentence. Frankly, I did not know. I had to be educated. And I think a lot of... And it's the same thing with... As we're getting a reckoning on working with disenfranchised groups, those of us that are in the privileged majority have got to learn, and we have to learn somehow. And I learned it by saying, oh, I'm going to do a Def West version of Parade. And then learned very quickly what a Herculean task it was and how I wasn't up for the task. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until working with Def Austin Theater and Brian Cheslick that I learned how important it is to have have in the leadership, not an assistant, not an associate, but a co-director that is part of that representational group. And in this case, we're talking about
Def. A visionary.
So it's... It's good. It's a good lesson to learn, and I encourage. And what I said, and I will say this, when we did Next to Normal, you know, we got lauded as being very brave for doing it. And I want to say that it's not a question of bravery. Mm-hmm. It's a question of commitment, because it is not easy and it is not inexpensive, but it is well worth it. And I would encourage.
And it's well worth it from an audience perspective to hear the people that I know, you know, came with me that have never experienced anything like that before, just to hear and have people look at things differently and experience something differently and realize it's just as enriching, if not more, in a totally different level. It's just so amazing. Yeah.
But the cool thing about doing things that are scary is you learn so much, and everybody wins. It is a win for everybody around, and it's amazing. And sure,
us agreeing today. This doesn't happen normally a whole hour.
That's crazy. Okay,
must have been those jazz hands.
Before we jump into Total Local, there's something else that I didn't talk about that I wanted to talk about, and I want folks to go to offstageonair.com and click the link to this New York Times article. We talked about how the Palace Theater got raised up 30 feet. Well, this article in the New York Times that just came out a few days ago.
I didn't send it to you because I was like, okay, surely Lisa read this, but it
shows all these pictures of exactly how it happened. And the things that it's doing, it's just amazing.
It only had to go up 30 inches, right? But no, it was
30 feet.
30, oh, was it 30 feet?
30 feet. Right, 30 feet. It goes up to two stories.
Hello, I'm foot inches. I'm only 5
feet.
But
what's interesting is they did do that. They brought it, so they told how they got all these hydraulic things and piers and beams and all that stuff. And then they raised it 6 inches. Stopped.
Yeah.
Built stuff underneath that, and then raised it another 6 inches.
That's what was so crazy. They had to keep doing it.
And then
by
at
inches.
10 or 15 feet, they stopped to build a first floor underneath it, and then they went up the other. It's just amazing.
It's just mind-boggling. Yeah. Human achievement.
So, and the Palace Theater has historic landmark classification. So, nothing could change. Like if they were off, they were saying if like one of the pumps, then I think there's like 30 different hydraulic pumps. If one of them is off just by a fraction of an inch, that could be catastrophic.
And it's amazing. Crazy. And these hydraulic pumps they use nowadays are teeny. They're like, what we used to do on a car jack to like lift up your tire is like 10 times bigger than, and they're these teeny little things, and they're just like, I know.
Well, actually, they got a whole bunch of teenage girls to surround it, hold hands, and say, light as a feather, stiff as a board.
Light as a feather, stiff as a board.
That's how they did it.
Okay, that did it. Was most excellent, Lisa.
Every
now
and the last thing I want to talk about is Tapestry Dance Company. They're doing their 22nd annual International Soul to Soul Tap Festival.
Yes.
And I should say that's Soul, S-O-U-L, to Soul, S-O-L-E. How clever is that? At the Rollins, and you can get more information at tapestrydance.com or org or something. Google Tapestry Dance. I don't have that.
And the longcenter.org.
Longcenter.org would also have it. It's happening June 8th through 12th at the Long Center, and we've done it.
Another show.
Another.
You didn't have any show today in theater history,
Today in theater history. Let's just do it real quick
because
that's the last song.
Lisa's got stuff. Tell us what happened.
Okay. Boys in the Band opened 2018. That would be the revival.
Oh, I was about to say, that's the revival, right?
I Remember Mama opened in 1979. I'm going to assume that's a revival, too.
I think it has to be. Wasn't that back in the Ziegfeld, like right after then?
It feels like it's back. I don't know if
it feels like someone would have been like this reporting on it.
Can't get away from that. Beatlemania opened in 1977. And The Comedy of Errors opened in 1987. And that's the original.
That's definitely the original on that one.
Yeah.
I drove my Pontiac then.
Also in 1971, You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown opened at the Golden.
Oh, happiness.
And here's some birthdays. Don Ameche, who I worked with.
Oh.
Margalo Gilmore. Don't know her, but she was born in 1897.
Oh.
Matt Cavanaugh. And Brooke Shields, Merle Dandridge, and Philippa Sue.
Okay.
Yeah. That's lovely. I totally forgot about that. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Well, it's just odd when we don't do it.
Yeah, and I should say, I did mention it at the top of the show. It is Pride Month. And you can see the Pride playbills on playbill.com. They show like a whole bunch of different Pride playbills. And I don't know if this... I tried to see their quote normal playbill, but Beetlejuice, most of people have just the Pride headline, the playbill that's rainbow, but Beetlejuice has a striped thing with rainbow colors. So I like that.
Yeah. Let's talk about next week, the cool set. There was a great article on the set designer guy. And speaking of Pride, the playwright Susan Sandler, who wrote the play Crossing Delancey about her life and also directed and did the movie, directed a film on comedian Julia Scotti and her transition in life as a comedian and going on. And that's a part of Eglif's Film Festival this weekend.
Okay, great. Well, we are out of time though. So you can see links to all the things we talked about and some of the links that we didn't talk about at offstageonair.com. I would like to thank Jarrett King, Yanina Barber Payne, and Mark Puhe for joining us here today and sticking with us the whole show. Thank
you. Yeah, this was really fun today. Thank you.
Love it.
Thank Nicole Shiro.
Shiro and Shep, Sheps and Shiro. Yeah.
So I don't know if you know it, Philippa Sue did a little show called Amelie.
Yes.
I'm not going to talk about it because we're running out of time. And DJ Mark is indeed trying to rip me away from this microphone. So we're just going to tell people to stick around and listen to Texas Music Mixtape. And you're going to listen to Tour de France from Amelie.
Tour de France.
Sir, may I lend a hand? May I take your cane? Careful up the curb. Here we go. Put away your cup, turning down the lane, listen to the squeak of the bakery cart, leaving a trail of breadcrumbs. Do you hear the laugh coming from the priest? He has crinkly eyes.